From Wrap Your Head Around Silks, this is the Expecting Ariel's podcast, now with the Digitent Network. How's it going, guys? Thank you so much for joining me today. Before we get started, Wrap Your Head Around Silks, lots of stuff coming up. I'll have a bit of a holiday sale for some of my online products, and then also teacher training 2024 Silks Level 1. I'm going to do an online version only this time around, so keep your eyes peeled. I wanted to give an opportunity for those people who cannot necessarily easily travel to get their training, so keep your eyes peeled for that. Also, of course, roll it out, the 60-minute virtual, two times a week. We hit the floor together on Zoom and we roll. It doesn't have to be Arielist. It could be your husband, your roommate, your mom who joins me. It's become an integral part of my maintenance process during the week, and I can help you guys. I also, since it's Zoom, I basically ask you how you're feeling and, you know, really create the hour for you guys. Also, everything on my body could get a roll. So no matter what we do, I'm getting benefit out of it. So I hope to see you guys there. There's always a 14-day free trial, and you can cancel it anytime. It's a $19 a month, you guys. It's not that much. It's just kind of a hard sell because people, honestly, it's a hard sell to get them to take care of themselves. So, but I think it's worth it. So here I am. All right, and today, I'm so excited for today. So this is part two of our two-part series on rheumatoid arthritis. I knew nothing about rheumatoid arthritis, honestly, before I did these episodes, and now I just learned so much. So today, this is Dr. Stephanie Munoz. She's a yoga therapist and researcher. She now lives in San Diego, but she completed her undergraduate work in biology and dance at Oberlin College. We went to college together. That's how I know her. And we were also dancing with each other for 4 years. She's a dear, dear friend. She earned an MFA at University of Maryland, as well as a CMA. Spent 8 years at Johns Hopkins University helping to develop and evaluate a yoga program for individuals with chronic diseases of rheumatoid arthritis and osteoarthritis. And it became her basis for her PhD in public health. So she has ongoing research collaborations with Einstein and Sinai Hospitals in New York, University of Maryland, Johns Hopkins, and she is just super impressive and also an amazing person. Her work has been covered by The Time, The Huffington Post, The Baltimore Sun, U.S. News and World Report. I can go on and on. Steph is in my heart for my whole life. And now that she lives on the West Coast, maybe I'll actually be able to see her in person. Bean is also singing in the back, if you can tell, but I figured I'd just go for it and keep on going. All right, guys, I am so excited for you guys to meet Dr. Stephanie Munoz. Let's get started. Okay, so Stephanie, I am I'm woefully ignorant of rheumatoid arthritis and how many people it affects and what are the symptoms and how people deal with this autoimmune disease. So if you would just like give your
bird's eye view synopsis.
Yeah. My leg.
Come here. Please.
So when people think about arthritis, they think about arthritis in its most prevalent form, which is osteoarthritis. Osteoarthritis tends to be more prevalent among older age groups. So the longer you live, the more likely you are to have it. By the time you reach the elderly years, you're more likely to have osteoarthritis than to not. And because of that, when people think arthritis, they think, oh yeah, I know somebody with arthritis, or I have a little arthritis myself. It's very different from what you're asking about, which is rheumatoid arthritis, because arthritis itself is not a specific disease. It's an umbrella category that has over 100 different diagnoses in it. So some that may be familiar are gout and psoriatic arthritis and degenerative disc disease and ankylosing spondylitis, so lupus. So rheumatoid arthritis is one of a category of arthritises that is an autoimmune condition. And your listeners probably know that an autoimmune condition means that your immune system is identifying some tissue in your own body as being foreign, not belonging there. And so your immune system does what it's designed to do, attack a foreign invader, except in this case, it's misidentified your own body as the foreign invader. So it is creating an immune response to your own body tissue. Like if somebody gets a cold or the flu or any sort of a viral or bacterial infection, you want your immune system to go at it and get that thing out of there. But it's problematic when that's your own tissue. Now, different forms of autoimmune disease attack different tissues of the body. Rheumatoid arthritis is an autoimmune disease that attacks the connective tissue of the synovial joints. So it's a systemic disease because in osteoarthritis, you have sort of wear and tear in a particular joint of the body, right? You're more at risk if you have a prior injury or you do a lot of repetitive motion or have excess body weight, or just over time, the more wear there is on that joint, the more the connective tissue is sort of worn down. And there's a little bit of inflammatory process there as well, but not to the extent of these autoimmune arthritises. Rheumatoid arthritis is more likely to hit in middle age than in older age, but there are also people very young who are diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis. So when it shows up in kids, it's actually a different disease. It's called juvenile idiopathic arthritis. And there are about 300,000 kids in the US who live with some form of systemic autoimmune arthritis. But as soon as you become an adult, your diagnosis would be one of the adult categories. So rheumatoid arthritis is an adult disease, but it can affect people as young as in their early 20s. It is characterized by the same kinds of symptoms that you get when you have a really bad flu, plus all of the things you think about when somebody has a joint disease. So on a joint level, you have pain and stiffness and swelling, reduced range of motion. On the systemic inflammatory side, you have things like feverishness and fatigue and foggy headedness. And so it can be really difficult with those two combinations of symptoms, what's happening on the joint level and that's what's happening on a whole systems level, to navigate these diseases, especially when they strike at an age when people aren't expecting to be living with arthritis.
Oh, it's almost like you've done that before, Steph.
And prevalence-wise, it affects about 1 to 2% of the population. So it's not super prevalent. If you add up all of these other systemic arthritises, like things like lupus that also have joint involvement, then the prevalence is higher. But that's compared to osteoarthritis, which is like 10 times more prevalent. So it's, if you think about, you know, you're in a room of 100 people, one person probably has RA, maybe two.
And Steph, if you could share with the audience what your specialty is.
So I'm a research scientist and a yoga therapist. And the focus of both my scientific work and also my clinical work is bringing the tools and practices of yoga to people who are living with arthritis and chronic pain.
Were you like a yoga teacher before you've decided to do all this, or were you just like a yogi, like you loved it?
I dabbled in yoga when I was younger. I got more interested during my master. I did a master's in choreography, master of fine arts in dance, and I was kind of leaning into yoga more. I became a yoga teacher in the way that many people become a yoga teacher, which is, oh, I'm just going to do this yoga teacher training for my own benefit, to grow my own practice, to go deeper into, you know, my understanding of yoga. And almost everyone who does that ends up being a teacher. What happened for me is that I had already determined that I was going to be a doctor of public health. And I identified pretty early on that what mattered to me in the sphere of public health was understanding the mind-body connection. You may recall, so our listeners may not know, that we went to Oberlin College together. I was a dance major and a biology major, and I was always interested in the mind-body connection and mind-body science, and especially how that could be harnessed to improve people's lives. And that's what took me into public health. I did not expect that as soon as I did my yoga teacher training, I was going to get hired by Johns Hopkins Rheumatology Department Division to be involved in a randomized clinical trial looking at the effects of yoga for people with rheumatoid arthritis and osteoarthritis.
I'm sure there's not a huge list of people who have that specialty in the United States.
We had to talk like Bowden and talk like Bowden did.
Listen. Okay, you want to hear it? Peaches.
You had to talk like Bowden.
Princess Peach, I would like you to marry me because I'm in love with you. That's all she wants to hear. Okay.
You are not this.
Okay, listen. I got to do the podcast. So there's not a huge list of those people who have that. I mean,
What's unique about me, Carrie, is that so there are some people who are scientists who study the effects of yoga. There are some people who are yoga therapists who work with people who have arthritis. There are other people who train yoga therapists or yoga teachers to offer more accessible yoga. And then there are other people who are like advocates in yoga spaces or arthritis spaces who are bringing these things together. And I am likely unique in that I do all of those things.
Okay, I see. So Steph, let's talk about prenatal postpartum. And imagine you've got a client who is a perinatal client and also has rheumatoid arthritis. What would be your approach?
Yeah, so something important to know about rheumatoid arthritis during that stage is that it's actually common for people to go into remission during pregnancy. And that's important because some of the medications that are necessary, when we think about managing an autoimmune disease, the way you do that is by like sort of softening the immune response, right? You use medications that tell your immune system to cool it, literally and figuratively. So immune suppressing medications are pretty serious medications, and some of them shouldn't be taken during pregnancy. So if you are someone who is fortunate to go into remission during pregnancy, then that kind of works out. And then you have to prepare yourself for what's going to happen during the birth and after the birth. And so there are complex decisions that need to be made with a rheumatologist and an obstetrician or whoever is supporting you in that birth planning and process about how do I navigate the well-being of this child and my own health and my capacity to care for this child through all of those ups and downs. There are also some people, not the majority, but there are some people who, instead of going into remission during pregnancy, actually flare. So something important to note about arthritis in general, but especially the systemic variety, is that they're unpredictable. And they flare based on a whole variety of factors. And what I mean by flare is there's sort of a spike in the disease activity and the symptoms. So you might be pretty well managed and you still have some pain and some stiffness and some fatigue, but you're sort of like able to do a lot of things in your daily life. And then one day you wake up and you can't get out of bed because your knee is swollen like a grapefruit, or you are, you know, feverish and exhausted. Different people have different, you know, sort of profiles of what a flare feels like and looks like. And that could be because of an infection, because of a major stressful life event, because of changes in hormones, or just seemingly out of the blue. So this is a disease that we know flares. And if you flare when you're pregnant and you're not able to use some of the medications that are important for managing a flare, that can be particularly challenging.
The aerialist that I talked to, she said, yeah, she was off her meds during the pregnancy and just crossing fingers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, and then the birth itself, I mean, listen, birth is traumatic. Like even when you have a healthy birth for mom and baby that goes exactly as planned, it's at least traumatic physically, if it's not also traumatic emotionally. And those types of stressors, so I'm talking about stress in a variety of different ways. There's the physiological stress on the body of the birth process. And then there is like the hormonal and emotional roller coaster of birth. Even if it's super positive, it's still what we call eustress, like the good stress. Like getting married is stressful, even if it's good stress. Having a baby is a hugely stressful and physically, if not emotionally, traumatic event. And so if you were ever likely to flare,
yeah,
you know, there are important considerations and also the risk. So aside from the risk of being on an immune suppressing medication when you're pregnant, and there are, you know, we can't lump all of these medications together, right? There are some things that you can definitely take when you're pregnant and they don't cross the barrier. And there are other things that you shouldn't. And again, that's a relationship, that's a decision to make between doctor and patient. But then what's going to happen through the birth experience? And then on the other side of the birth experience, when now not only do you have to sort of get back on track with managing your disease, if you were lucky to be in remission during pregnancy, you may no longer be in remission, right? You could be in a flare. But even without a flare, you're still living with an autoimmune disease. And now you're managing the sleeplessness and the feedings and the not knowing what the heck you're doing and navigating, you know, what your support structures are. And if you work, how you're going to figure that out. So I don't know if this was true for you, Carrie, but I mean, that postpartum period, there's a lot. It's a lot. Yeah. It's a lot for a perfectly healthy human.
Yeah.
And so it's just, there's so much more. And so you were asking, what do I do? Like, what's my approach? And so I should first say that yoga, the way that I see and offer yoga, it's not what we would call modern postural yoga, which is like, here are some positions you can put your body in that might improve your fitness and mobility. Yeah, that is great. And it's a tiny fraction of what yoga is, right? Yoga is a mind-body practice, and it includes a whole toolbox, including breath regulation and mindfulness, meditation, relaxation, applied philosophy, movement, postures, lifestyle. And so I'm looking at that whole toolbox and the specific human that I'm working with, because it's not a, well, here's what you should do if you're postpartum with RA. It's like, what's going on for you? And what's most important to you? What do I see through a yogic lens that seems like an imbalance that we might be able to address with yoga practices? And also what's going to work in your life? Because I'm not going to give somebody who is postpartum with an autoimmune disease, you know, an hour-long mat practice that they're supposed to do every day. Right? It's going to be, how do you breathe differently when you're feeling overwhelmed? And how do you get a little bit more sleep and get back to sleep after you've been awakened? And so maybe that's a progressive relaxation, or maybe that's a mantra that is like a positive message to themselves that they can use. So it's going to look really different for each person. And of course, it's not a replacement for medical care. It's ancillary too. So it's like, all right, you're working with your doctor on how to manage this medically. What are all the things that you can do in your life that are A, going to help the medicine work better, B, going to maybe allow you to be on less a lesser dose, or, you know, less likely to flare while you're on that medication. So it's a way to be a participant in your own disease management instead of leaving it solely to your medical team.
My population are a bunch of A-type personalities who are obsessed with this one particular sport.
Yeah.
Very upper body based. Like, it's so funny because as a dancer, like, my legs barely get a workout now. It's all my upper body. I do stretch, but, you know, so we have a lot of not even the people with this autoimmune, just generally,
right?
Shoulder issues.
Yeah,
a lot of shoulder issues in this population. Rotator cuff, labrum tears. Overall,
yeah.
I have never experienced, well, I might have, but I've PT'd myself out of it.
Yeah.
We use a lot of the rib cage muscles, and people don't really know how to maintain them. Like the serratus anterior, the teres minor major just get completely wrecked for us, mostly because people don't know how to take care of it.
Yeah.
And the pecs get really, really tight. People's shoulders start to turn in. We have a lot of neck pain that could be associated with the rib cage and arm stuff.
There's so much I want to say already, Carrie.
No, okay, I'm going to stop. You go.
Okay. So one thing is, people who are drawn to this sport, perhaps similarly to people who are drawn to dance and people who are drawn to yoga, are probably people who have a predisposition toward hypermobility in the first place, right? Like, because I'm super bendy, I'm really good, you know, I'm using air quotes, because there's no such thing as being good at yoga, but the way that yoga is portrayed in the West, it's like, oh, I can pretzel myself into all of these wild and crazy positions, and that means I'm good at this thing. And it's performative, and it makes me feel really successful that I can do all of this stuff. And for someone who has a propensity toward hypermobility, that is not where you should be spending your time in terms of conditioning the body. You need stability and structure. And this is true also in gymnastics, right? That like, because I'm super bendy, not only am I going to be drawn to the kinds of activities that take advantage of my bendiness, but I'm going to lean even harder into like all of these crazy things I can do with my body, especially when it's an art form and it's based on responding to the gaze, right? Like, what can I do with my body to make you ooh and ah? Instead of like what's actually best for the structure that I have. And so the cross training of like stabilizing activities and, you know, what you're talking about, these tendencies of like tight packs, and it requires an awareness of where am I tight? Where am I loose? What do I need to do in order to create balance in the system, even in my neutral posture? And that requires a self-awareness, paying attention to the experience in the body and having boundaries for self about like, why am I going this far into this thing? Is it because it impresses other people? Is it because it feels good to me? Is it because it's what's best for me in this moment? And deciding what values do I want to use in the decision making of how I'm going to practice my craft. And I think probably, Carrie, at this point in your work, you have come to some decisions about things that don't make sense to do in the same way that you once did, which I think is it's a maturity that comes with being an older artist, where you start to understand actually preserving my tool is more important than how impressive I might look in this particular moment.
The reason I was laughing to myself while you're talking is because I just like out recently was like contortion over 40 and how, and how like one of my friends like started at 36 and it now is 46 and is like bending her back in half like she's a sandwich the other way. And then
The question is like, can you do that in a way that is
right,
honoring your body's lifelong trajectory? Like, can you do that in a way that allows you to stay stable and strong? And, you know, maybe it's possible to do that in the same way. I mean, like, athletes that perform into their 40s, they have a whole team of people that is helping them to make the best decisions possible to keep playing and hopefully still be able to walk when they retire from the sport. But that's a decision that each person has to make about not only do I continue doing this into my old age, but like, how do I do it? And, you know, for example, in dance, you can be a really beautiful, engaging, inspiring performer in old age and the choices that you make as a dancer look completely different, but you lean into what you do best as a wise and mature human, which is probably more artistry, more nuance, more subtlety than like big athletic feats.
Yeah. And also laughing to myself while you were talking about that, because I was like, no, I'm completely in denial. What are you talking about? I am actively in denial of the things that I have had to like leave out of my practice. Actually, for me, I don't have hypermobility, and I really have to fight for flexibility and strength. Yeah. Both.
Right.
Both don't come easily. So I'm actually a pretty healthy body if I'm maintaining, because my body will not allow me to go farther.
So I don't know if you've heard this expression, Carrie. It's like a little sad as a mother, but I've heard it said, birth is the beginning of a long string of goodbyes.
Oh, that is sad.
Right. But it's true, because
why? Because your body changes so much.
No. Because you birth this child, right? Like you are saying goodbye to them as like a part of your own body. And then everything that they do, stepping out into their own individuality as a human, is a step away from you. So you're saying goodbye to, you're saying goodbye to the breastfeeding, goodbye to the diapers, and goodbye to the, like, you know, the hand feeding, and goodbye to the like holding hands on the walk to school, and goodbye to like waking them up in the morning, and like all of that. It's a long string of goodbyes, and then eventually you say goodbye completely, right? Well, I'll give you a moment to just
I also said that. Goodbye to my continence, because I gave it all to her.
Yeah, there you go. But also you could say the same for your physical practice. So I'm going to talk about this from a yoga perspective. There are poses that you let go of because they just don't make sense to do anymore. And so just like you grieve, like no longer nursing your baby or no longer walking them to school, but it's like the right thing to do because it's important for them to be able to have that autonomy in their own lives. Well, it's the right thing for me to do to like not be, I don't know, doing a pose that puts all of my weight on the top of my skull, right? Like that does not make sense for someone who probably has some degenerative changes in my spine just based on age alone. And so the question is, when am I ready and willing to say goodbye to that particular part of my practice? And over time, there will be more and more, like at some point, I'm going to let go of the splits. And at some point, I'm going to, you know, let go of arm balances and whatever. And the last pose that you're left with is the corpse pose, right? You're just lying there, a body without a soul. And like part of yoga philosophy is non-attachment, that like being non-attached to the body, being non-attached to the practice, being non-attached to like your personality, your role in the world. And these diseases like RA, they force you to reckon with that probably sooner than you would expect to. And on a day-to-day basis, like that is not happening for me today. And that may be sad for me because I really want to get on the floor and play with my kid. And it's not the right choice for me to make in that moment. And that's going to be a little bit sad. And it's also going to be really important.
Steph, do you remember we were, so I was in touch with Nusha Martinuk for a while after college.
I just talked to her last week.
Shut up. I need to reach out to her. Also, because the last time I spoke to her, I was like in a really weird, I was in a really terrible place with my dance career. And I was like, Nusha, I don't know if I should have done this in the first place. She was like, what are you talking about? I was having a bad day. I remember she was putting on her last performance. By then, she had lost all the cartilage in her ankle. So she couldn't do a plie, which is insane for a dancer to not to be able to do a plie. And she was also dealing with scoliosis her whole life. And this is our dance professor from college. She is now retired, right?
Yeah.
Retired from teaching. And this the moment I'm talking about is her retiring from dancing, which was well into her 50s, if not 60s. Steph, do you know that?
I feel like 60. Well, I feel like she's in her 60s now, but it wasn't, how long ago was it that she retired? Well, let's see. My daughter was there.
Okay.
At the show. My daughter is 15 and she was probably like early elementary school, like 7. So yeah. So it could be late 50s, early 60s.
You're talking
maybe
about this performance about the scoliosis and like the graphics that she had. I never saw it.
Yeah.
I saw pictures of it. So she put this performance together, and by then her dance practice had changed so much from when I learned from her, when you learned from her, because, you know, right, we graduated college in 1999. So this is kind of what you're talking about, and doing it gracefully and doing it with respect to your own body and your own practice. So is this kind of like the sad devolving of a rheumatoid arthritis mover, though?
Well, okay. So one thing I want to say is because
that got
Nusha
really dark.
Nusha and I talked last week, and actually part of our conversation is about like, how does dance show up in your life when you're not a performer? Like both for me as somebody in my mid-40s whose job has nothing to do with dancing, but like dancing lights me up. And I am a better human when I have like some time and space to just like put on some music and like jam in a space somewhere. But we were also talking about what does dance look like when you're in your 60s and you're retired and you have grandkids, like, you know, and dance. And I think aerial work is probably different from this, but like you could dance with your little finger, right? Like there is no point.
Yeah.
And the same thing is true of yoga, because yoga is anything that unites the mind and body in a unified experience. So there's no point when you can't dance anymore, right? Like you could be paralyzed and dance with your eyeballs, but it will look very different. And for someone with RA, the decision-making process is just, RA is always a factor in that decision. RA is not a life sentence like it used to be. The medication that's available now is remarkable and advancing all of the time. And it is possible to live like totally normal lifespan, high quality of life, but there will always be the impact of RA on any given decision. Should I take this trip or not? Should I, you know, do this extra bit of housework or not? Should I make this additional commitment or not? Knowing that the ramifications of that choice are going to be different. So it's not that people with RA can't be active people. They have to take into consideration which joints are involved, right? Because RA shows up differently in everyone, and more joints tend to be affected over time. So it starts out with the fingers maybe, and then it's in the wrists, and then it's in the shoulders, or what, however it might progress. And so the joints that are affected are going to impact what activities are possible. How can I do those activities? There are lots of ways to adapt things. And so, you know, what does it mean to like lose grip strength if you're an aerialist? Are there things that you do with the silks where you're like wrapping it around your hand differently so there's not as much grip required of you? Are you making different choices with what you do with your hips because one of your hips is affected by the arthritis? So there are choices that have to be made where RA plays a role, but it's not that you have to hang it up and leave it behind entirely.
Yeah, I feel like that happens, that those decisions happen for people just as they're getting older. Like sometimes
yeah.
silks, they end up, people end up going to hammock or sling, which is more supportive. Sometimes they end up being on a lira because the grip is so different. You know, you're on a steel bar versus a vertical hanging fabric. And, you know, even though it's a cylindrical grip, it's different that it's vertical versus horizontal. Mm-hmm. So this happens a lot. I've had a lot of friends that like they come in and they're like, my pinky finger's not working today. Mm-hmm. That's more problematic than your index finger not working, because the index finger plays such a different role in the grip strength.
Mm.
So, you know, like the three back fingers of the hand are way more involved. So, Steph, I miss you so much. I like you guys, listeners, you know, when you have like old friends and then you just, you know, life happens. And I also don't love when friends, when it just like you should be able to disconnect and reconnect. And it just feels like 2 seconds have passed. Also, Stephanie ages like she's not a white girl, even though she is.
Carrie, you know, I just moved
to San Diego.
Yeah. So
yeah, we could see each other.
We should actually see each other in real life and like, you know, have like a big fat old hug, because I do feel like we are the kind of friends that you can reconnect and no time has passed. And also, you look exactly the same from when we were in college.
You look exactly the same to me, but I have a theory that because we're just looking through our lenses, like I think we looked like babies right before. And I just got my hormone panel back and it is showing perimenopause. So I'm actually going, I'm going in tomorrow. I'm actually happy that the test results show what I'm feeling because
it validates,
your
experience.
And then my female doctors are like, you're fine, because I'm more fit than the normal population. Yeah. I was like, no, let's deal with this. And then of course the blood test, I was like, see,
you know your body.
I know my body.
And that's actually what I say to the people I work with. Like, I'm bringing the expertise about yoga and about public health. You are the world's leading expert of your own body mind. And we're going to work together to figure this out, because, you know, I can't just, like I said earlier, make blanket recommendations based on a diagnosis. It has to work for this particular person, not just with where they are in their lives, but with their where they are in that moment. Which, and I think, you know, something that I said when you walked away is, it's a moment-to-moment process of being aware and making the right decisions. We're not always going to make the right decisions. But then, you know, the more we practice mindful awareness, the more we realize sooner and with less consequence, oh, that wasn't the right decision. Let me make an adjustment and course correct.
Well, and of course it is very hard to give advice en masse, right? But you did manage to write a book. So that is, so for my ladies out there who are dealing with this, I'm going to also link the book in the show notes, but is there anything that, I mean, if they don't have access to somebody like you, what can we do as a starter?
Right. So it's important to know the difference between a yoga teacher and a yoga therapist. A yoga teacher, in general, is trained to offer yoga to groups of people, whoever they are, however they come. Yoga therapists are trained to assess an individual and design a plan of care using the tools of yoga based on their particular needs and imbalances that might be showing up. So if you want individualized care that's based on your own particular concerns, especially somebody living with, I mean, not just things like RA, but, you know, a torn labrum or whatever it is that somebody might be dealing with, you want to seek out a yoga therapist. And so IAYT.org, the International Association of Yoga Therapists, is a place where you can find a yoga therapist, either somebody who will work with you on Zoom or somebody who is in your local geographic area. And you want to pick out somebody who has experience and training specifically working with arthritis or injury or, you know, athletic injuries, chronic pain, whatever it is you may be dealing with, menopause, premenopause, perimenopause, you know, they're prepartum, postpartum, whatever. There are yoga therapists who specialize in navigating those particular journeys. But if you're going to go to a yoga class or do a session with a yoga teacher, it is really on you to show up with an understanding of what's going on in your body, what you should or should not be doing, what you're trying to get out of it, what your needs are. So talk to your doctor in advance. Say, you know, I'm going to go to yoga. What should I avoid? What should I be careful about? What might be particularly helpful? So a yoga therapist is going to help you figure that out. But if you're going to a yoga teacher, figure that out with your doctor. Also, it really helps a yoga therapist if you can bring that information from your doctor, because it gives them a head start in figuring out how to best serve you.
I didn't even know there's a yoga therapist. I didn't know there's a thing. That's amazing.
Yeah. So it's like 5 times the training of a yoga teacher.
Okay.
There are some yoga teachers who have really gone above and beyond their basic training and developed specialized knowledge, and they have, you know, decades of experience working with a special population. And so you might find somebody like that, who's technically a yoga teacher, but they're really an appropriate person to go to. But if you want to be sure that they have this skill set, then you want to seek out a yoga therapist.
Okay. You have a podcast now, right?
Yeah. The Yoga Room. Room, like rheumatology.
How's that going? Are you liking the...
Oh, I love it.
No, me too.
I should have done it a really long time ago. It was like, you know, like as a creative person, you understand this, Carrie, like you have a seed of an idea and like, it's just like hanging out there waiting to be birthed. And you're like, okay, I have a lot of other things to do. I'll get to you later. And so the podcast was, I even knew what I was going to call the podcast, like probably a decade ago. It just took me a while to get there.
Was it just busy life or was it procrastination?
No, it was just a whole bunch of other priorities. Yeah. Like writing my second book and, you know,
yeah,
COVID and all those things. Yeah.
Yeah. I love it. I love that you have a podcast. I love that I have a podcast. I would love to make money doing the podcast. That would be really
yeah,
nice.
Well.
But ever since I started my podcast, the worldwide number of podcasts has gone from 2.5 million to 5 million. Doubled.
Oh, wow.
Doubled.
I don't even pay attention to those things. That's wild.
Yeah.
I mean, I really started it just because I felt like there were conversations
yeah.
that like needed to be had that I wanted to get out into the world. And also as a way to sort of spread information about that this is even a thing. I mean, like sometimes I'll wear a Yoga for Arthritis t-shirt and people will stop me and be like, oh, I have arthritis. Like, where should I go for yoga? Or how can somebody with arthritis do yoga? Right. There's just isn't broad awareness of this.
Yeah.
And so the podcast is also just a way to get the word out.
I love that. Okay. So, Steph, thank you for coming on. I miss you. We'll see each other.
Yeah.
We'll see each other. But, thank you for sharing this knowledge. This is actually a great like cap to like what, the other interview, because, you know,
great.
She was speaking from like, this is
personal experience.
Yeah, personal experience, the way
yeah.
I wake up in the morning, what it feels like. And this is like
right.
all on the other side. So, all right, Steph, you want to say bye to Steph?
Bye. Here,
hold on.
Bye, sweetie. It was so much fun to meet you.
Let's see.
Bye.
Bye. Mwah.
All right, Steph. It was just so great to catch up with you, and you're just so accomplished in your career around this very specific topic. Honestly, I do not understand why I waited. We're at the end of my third season. I really don't know why I didn't call you sooner, but it doesn't matter. You're here now and schooled me on rheumatoid arthritis. So I'm appreciative of that as well. My friends, if you would honor me with a 5-star rating and review anywhere you get your podcasts, it helps so much for the podcast to make it through our community worldwide. It really does help. And take a look at Wrap Your Head Around Silks online. I've got a lot of resources for you. Keep an eye peeled. Teacher training next year and also some holiday specials for you. And then, Greener Grass. It's the podcast I do with Kelly McVeigh. We talk about so many different things. So if you just want to deep dive into things that you never necessarily thought you would think about, then it's a great place to be. We also do a weekly roundup every other week, just catching up, girl talk. Hopefully we light up your day, light up your laundry, or light up your dishes, whatever you happen to be doing, driving while listening. Digital Podcast is our umbrella network. We appreciate you guys. And thanks for being here. All right, over and out. This is Carrie. Wrap Your Head Around Silks. This is the Expecting Her.